From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Noel Mehring, author of Awake, Not Woke, A Christian Response to the Cult of Progressive Ideology. Let's now join Hank and Noel Mehring in their conversation.
You want to get your will in line with your reason. So you want to identify, okay, this might be what I want, this might be pleasurable, but I ought to do this. And then through that process, you begin to have an affection for the good, right? You begin to actually desire the good. You know, this is how we become self-governing, self-ruling individuals. And so the movement inverts that. It says, no, what you ought to do is the thing that you want to do. Your will is primary. This can be called expressive individualism, that our goal and freedom in life is identifying how we become authentic, is by identifying the desires that are most going to liberate us, which are most in defiance of moral norms, and then embracing those desires and then expressing them, living them out in the world. That's how we become powerful. And we might cooperate with other people who are, you know, momentarily, maybe we'll marry someone. That doesn't necessarily preclude marriage. Insofar as it works for you and it works for me, then this is working for both of us. But insofar as, you know, this no longer feels like I'm truly living my authentic self, or I'm not really, this is somehow hindering my full expression of something in me, then this is no longer serving me. I think we see this in subtle ways, but also in more overt ways. For example, like if you have ever stumbled upon a pride parade, it almost feels like a competition for the most outlandish presentation of self, with the idea being that the more we buck every social norm, then the more free we truly are being. And this has a consequence, particularly of, I think, corruption of innocence. So we see this now kind of explode on the scene, this idea of like drag queens for children, transgender, you know, parties and, you know, dances, family-friendly transgender events. And I think oftentimes we think, well, it's so fringe, it's so odd, you know, I can't wrap my mind around it. So it must be just I'm not seeing something, or there's something just bizarre about it. But it really makes sense, according to the movement, that the child's innocence of the alternative sexualities is in some way perpetuating a dominance of a traditional social norm, that the kid who kind of giggles at seeing a grown man in a miniskirt and high heels dancing, that giggling is his innate, that innate discomfort is something that actually is oppressing the man in the miniskirt, right? Because it's signaling that there's a way that ought to be, and that this is somehow deviating from that. And so you have to disabuse kids from their innocence of alternative lifestyles in order to disabuse society's idea that there is a norm. So that's the second dogma. The last dogma is power over authority. Ed Fazer, a philosopher, came up with a great statement. He said, modern man is essentially Oedipal, wants to kill the father and defile the mother. And the father being a symbol of authority and the mother being a symbol of innocence and goodness. And so that a killing of the father, that sort of patricide, I think, is imbued throughout the third dogma, that we reject the idea, if we're woke, that there is an objective good, that authority itself is good. And where we see anything that's authoritative or hierarchical, we're trained to now see it only as domination, corrupt domination. Whereas, you know, I think as Christians, we understand it to be the exact opposite, right? That something that has authority or someone who's given authority is inherently pointing to a reverence that should be demanded of us, that authority is only given to us by something higher than us. Bishop Fulton Sheen has a great quote where he says something to the effect of, beware of anyone who tries to lead who has not first learned to obey, that there's some connection there. And authority itself, I think the etymology of the word means springs from an origin, that fatherhood is something that is life-giving, but it also is something that, you know, the child first has his own father before he becomes a father himself, that there is that connection through a line, through a generation, it's generative. But if you remove that idea of an objective good, then authority really becomes arbitrary. It just becomes power. And so because the woke movement is fundamentally atheistic, there is no objective good. There is no benevolent father. There is no God or author of our lives. There is only the raw grasp of power, the will to power. And so I think the logos is the ultimate target of this movement. The logos being, you know, in the three dogmas, the first that thing that's rejected is the person. The second that's rejected is reason. And the third thing rejected is authority, which are the three characteristics of the Logos, who's the mind of God manifest in the person of Jesus Christ, who is the author and authority of all. And I think that he is the ultimate target.
You do some alliteration in the book that I find very helpful. For example, you talk about the woke weapons, those woke weapons being the muzzle and the microphone. Expand on that a bit.
Yeah, that actually, the muzzle and microphone, actually, I think I got that from a writer named Michael Anton, who wrote a book called The Stakes. And that was the idea that, well, particularly with media, you know, that the media has a muzzle and a megaphone. So they can silence narratives that they don't want to promulgate, and they can exacerbate, exaggerate, and endlessly amplify narratives that serve their cause. I think anyone who's followed the media for some time, this has been a real source of frustration, right? That there's particularly stories that serve kind of any way to reveal or expose a bad, you know, straight white male or right a person who's conservative or what have you, that these stories are almost gleefully, you know, amplified. And that's not to say that there's real injustices that can happen on either side that are important stories and that should be discussed. But I think people have lost a lot of trust in the institution of mainstream media, and for good reason. You know, and I think that the greater error would be to keep trusting something that has shown itself to be so distrustful time and time again. You know, I think that that it really is the reasonable response to this corruption.
Yeah, a lot that could be said in that regard. One of the issues that you deal with in the book is how we're being broken up into categories of identity. And those categories of identity continue to multiply. So when the subject of diversity is brought up, it's almost neutered of any value because there's so much diversity, you can't even count it.
Yeah, that's right. So I think that was in the section I was talking about intersectionality. So that started with, there was a legal scholar named Kimberly Crenshaw. And at some point, I think in the late 80s, she made a real case for there might be ways in which someone belongs to two groups that are oppressed. So, for example, if companies are striving to be more diverse, and they might say, okay, you need to hire more women and you need to hire more minorities. Well, every company could hire, this is her argument, every company could hire Black men and white women, and they're checking off the box of a racial minority, and they're also checking off the box of women. And who is lost in that equation? The Black woman, that there's, you know, because she's compounded with her oppressed identities. You know, and that on the face of it, there's something true that she's saying, right? Certainly, setting aside whether or not it's legitimate for companies to hire based on identity, you know, which is a different discussion. But if you grant that it is, then there is something true that she's saying. But the problem is that, you know, how do you calculate for the potential amount of oppression or hardships that a person has experienced? Are we going to say that, for example, the daughters of Barack Obama are more oppressed than, you know, someone who grows up in, you know, Appalachia, you know, with an abusive family and zero money? You know, there's so many different ways of what you can look at one person's life and see what challenges that they have. But the point is that, you know, we're training people to lean into the challenges that they grew up with, not to try to transcend those challenges. And I think it really is a movement of despair in that way. But as you say, and Jordan Peterson talks about this too, that if you could, there's an incalculable amount of ways you could potentially analyze those things. So are you older? Are you younger? There's advantages to being young. There's advantages to being older too. Are you short? Are you attractive? Are you not attractive? You know, but the movement's not interested in all of those sorts of nuances. They want to say, okay, there are approved identity categories and that's it. You don't look at those and any of those other potentials in life. You only look at the ones that are politically approved of, and that's how you analyze the human person. It's really unnuanced in that way.
You write about the rejection of natural law, sort of cutting off the branch in which you're sitting. Can you expand on that a little?
Sure. Well, in the second dogma, will over reason. So that's natural law is the idea that there is an intelligibility and a purpose to the created order. And so my job in learning and understanding how to live a happy life, a life of well-being, not happy in the sense of pleasure necessarily, but a flourishing life, is to understand what sort of creature I am and then live my life accordingly. So that means that there's a telos to life, right? There's an end. There's some place that we are aiming towards, you know, and that's how we understand sin. Sin is a missing of the mark, you know, that there is a mark to identify. The movement rejects the idea that there's a telos at all. So it rejects not only our origin in rejecting the Father, it also rejects our future, our end, our purpose. And it really is unmooring in that way, where the person is sort of orphaned from both a history and a future, a destiny. And insofar as, you know, there's something I think that might feel maybe to young people, especially these days. You know, sometimes you hear younger people talk about how we can kind of be anything now. You know, that's what's really freeing, is that there's not some kind of rote, you know, path carved out for me. But the problem is that people don't really flourish if they don't understand what kind of thing they are. You know, that we are created beings, and we try to find our freedom outside of true knowledge of who we are and what our purpose is. It might feel for a minute like it's liberating, but it's actually going to be deeply an avenue of despair. But yeah, so that rejection of natural laws, a rejection of that there's intelligibility to the created order and a purpose to our lives.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Noelle Mehring. With a wit and clarity that both exposes the absurd and mourns the brokenness of our culture, Noelle Mehring provides answers to such questions as, why have politics become all-absorbing? Why is dysfunction being normalized and celebrated? Why is violence the natural end of woke ideology? And why is the corruption of children a logical outgrowth of woke principles? The crisis that grips our culture is a spiritual battle. It is not accidental. The architects of revolution have long known that the transformation of the West had to come by way of destabilizing the social, familial, and religious pieties of a citizenry. To receive your copy of Awake, Not Woke, A Christian Response to the Cult of Progressive Ideology by Noelle Mehring, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Has God spoken? Are the words of Scripture merely human in origin, or are they in fact the very words of God Himself? 3 years in the making, and based on 2 decades of research and reflection, Hank Hanegraaff's monumental book, Has God Spoken?, answers what is surely the most important question facing our world. In Has God Spoken? Memorable Proofs of the Bible's Divine Inspiration, Hank counters the contentions of the Bible attackers and clearly shows that belief in the Holy Scriptures is not a guess or wishful thinking. It is the only logical conclusion after an honest examination of overwhelming evidence. Order Has God Spoken? From the Christian Research Institute by calling 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Equip.org. Bertrand Russell famously said, most people would rather die than think, and many of them do. Not so with CRI support team members. Support team members are not only serious thinkers, but their membership in CRI's support team helps to equip hundreds of thousands of fellow believers around the globe each and every month. Are you not a member? Then you're missing out. Not only do support team members form the backbone of Christian Research Institute's outreaches, but they enjoy their selection of resources from our Equipping Essentials library and receive a complimentary subscription to CRI's award-winning Christian Research Journal. Just 2 of the benefits of membership. To discover how you can make a difference 24/7 in equipping believers at home and abroad to stand for life and truth, check out the benefits of membership at equip.org. Endless predictions about end time events and published timetables counting down the end have proven to be wrong 100% of the time. When doomsday predictions fail, there is double duty damage. Many theologically juvenile and scripturally superficial Christians abandon the faith as a result of these failed predictions, and the public image of Christianity is damaged, making Christians appear to be hopelessly naive and easily duped biblical bumpkins. Hank Hanegraaff's book, Prophetic Stars in the Constellation of Biblical Prophecy, will equip you not only to interpret biblical prophecy correctly, but to remember it as well. To receive your copy of Prophetic Stars as our thank you for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org. Let's rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Noel Mehring, in their conversation.
When you talk about wokeism, I mean, we can talk about it in an abstract sense, but we're really talking about an ideology that is bent on not reconstructing America or Western civilization, but absolutely destroying it and then erecting something out of the ashes. And that's all considered to be progressive.
That's right. Yeah. I think that it's, you know, this is another way that it's a movement of despair, is that it's training people to think, if there's something wrong in my life, if there's an injustice in my life, or I'm, you know, a victim or on the line of oppressor and oppressed, there's nothing that I can actually do to change that or to transcend that. I can only destroy the systems that have been oppressing me. So that the problems in my life are not on the personal level, they're on the systemic level. And so the system has to be blamed or credited for any good or bad that comes into my life entirely. It's really stripping the individual of any sort of sovereignty or ability to grow in virtue or to acknowledge vice. You know, and insofar as it strips that the individual of that sort of moral agency, it leads a person to despair. Because if you can't control anything in your life other than be enraged by it, well, it's not going to be a path to happiness.
We have actually moved towards the inconceivable. And you're right about that. The fact that corporations are now paying millions of dollars to train their people in woke ideology. You have the U.S. Embassy flying the pride flag, and on it goes. So the inconceivable has now become reality, not just in America, but in a broader sense of the West.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, I think it's going to keep increasing. I mean, I'm sure people are hearing more and more about the ESG. So it's this new sort of a social credit score that's going to be increasingly demanded of corporations, which, how do you rate on environmental, social justice, governance? And a company can be ostensibly denied funding or, you know, the ability to do banking, you know, certain government subsidies based on these scores. So one of the things I'm trying to figure out is, you know, what is it in the corporation's interest? So obviously, if they see that that's where the future is heading, then they want to be on the right side now, right? Because they're going to see that you're going to get punished. And the more you stick your neck out, the more harm that's going to come your way. But I also think that there might be an element that is, you know, we no longer talk about class divisions as much, right? We don't talk about, you know, the rich being oppressors and the poor being the oppressed. Insofar as we have focused so much on race and, you know, all of these and these other categories, I wonder if it just gives sort of people who are running corporations sort of a way to, you know, a shield of virtue, you know. And I'm not saying that because you're a successful businessman, that means you're an oppressor. That's not my belief at all. But I'm saying that if there is a struggle there, there is a way of, you know, insofar as you can deflect from, you know, and find your virtue and align with by these kind of relatively easy methods of hiring a DEI expert and training your employees on all of these things. It gives you this veneer of protection, I think. So I'm not certain exactly why so many corporations are going along with it, but I do know that there's a lot of people who are really unhappy about it. People who don't feel, and they're not cowards, they're just not, you know, they're being prudent. They don't feel like they can speak up in their companies, and their companies are instituting this more and more every year. It gets more and more obnoxious and in your face and coercive, but they don't want to participate in it. And so, you know, there's a way in which if you can galvanize all of those people, you know, to form new institutions, that could be, you know, one way out of this. I have a friend who's doing some work to that end in a group called New Foundings, but, and I know of other people who are trying to formulate this too, but the economic means of resisting the woke movement, I think is going to become increasingly more important and vital if we're to see our way out of this.
I want to get to a phrase you use in the book. And I find this to be a poignant and profound phrase. It's the phrase prowling for innocence. And it conjures up all kinds of images in my mind. Satan prowling around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he can devour and so forth. So this prowling for innocence, I mean, I think that's the heart of wokeism. It seems to be the complete devolution of the institutions that ought to be protecting children.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it makes sense in a way because innocence, if we are ashamed, innocence can stand in judgment of us without even meaning to, right? Because innocence points us to a standard, points us to something good, to something beautiful. And You know, I think there's something really psychological, but also deeply spiritual happening there, that the innocent stand in judgment. And there's also something I think really spiritual happening with, I think, going to chapter 7, the idea that Christ is the perfectly innocent victim, right? He's characterized in his sacrifice as being perfect victim, perfectly innocent, and then an ultimate victor. And the woke are trying to, I think, in some ways, deify themselves. Not that everyone in the woke movement understands it on this level, but I think this is what the movement tends toward, is trying to claim his victimhood by proclaiming themselves as oppressed, but then also trying to grasp at his innocence. And they can't really grasp at the innocence, right? Because innocence means, you know, acknowledging objective good and living in accord with it and protecting the innocence of others. But they can grasp at it by trying to destroy innocence in this world, and then in some ways achieve a sort of relative or analogous innocence for themselves. That there's a certain blamelessness, I think, that they, you know, strive for, that I can't be held accountable because X, Y, and Z. And that, I think, is connected to the prowling for innocence in this life, right? That directing it at children. I'm not sure if I articulate it totally, but I think there's various layers happening there.
Yeah, and a couple of things I was reading today and actually listening to, the culpability of the medical institutions now. So you have the medical establishment surrendering, Kaiser Permanente, Boston Children's Hospital, Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. And I want to play a quick clip and have you respond to this clip, because, again, it seems to me absolutely unthinkable that you have these major medical institutions that have capitulated to woke ideology, and they do it in a matter-of-fact way. Here's an example.
So most of the patients that we have in the GEMS clinic actually know their gender, usually around the age of puberty, but a good portion of children do know as early as seemingly from the womb, and they will usually express their gender identity as very young children, some as soon as they can talk. They might say phrases such as, I'm a girl, or I'm a boy, or I'm going to be a woman, or I'm going to be a mom. Kids know very, very early. So in the GEMS clinic, we see a variety of young children all the way down to ages 2 and 3, and usually up to the ages of 9. When they come into the clinic, they'll see one of our psychologists, and we'll be talking to them about their gender. We'll be talking to their family about how to best support that child and how to make sure that that child has the space and support to explore their gender and do well throughout their development. And we'll be answering any parent questions. A lot of parents do have questions, and so we answer those questions. The biggest piece of advice I give parents who are coming through the gender clinic at Boston Children's Hospital is to just be supportive. Sometimes you might not understand. Sometimes you feel like you don't know the terms, or you don't kind of get exactly what the child means when they say that they might be this gender. But the biggest thing you can do is just love your child and support them and just allow them to express themselves. That's the biggest protector as well against negative mental health effects such as depression, suicidality, anxiety that we worry about for our gender diverse kids and young adults. So that support from a parent is one of the best protective factors and one of the best things they can do.
This is Dr. Kerry McGregor of Boston Children's Hospital. And so matter of fact, you just have to, as parents, capitulate to the woke ideology and whatever your kids happen to be thinking at a very early age. And in terms of transgenderism, you can also have a sense of who you are about the time that you're emerging from the womb.
Yeah, I think that this is where the rubber meets the road in a way, right? Because the absurdity is almost too much to bear. And if the movement, they've done such a good job of training us to not be able to trust our own ability to access what is real and what is true, that we become, in that inability to trust our own understanding of what is true and what's real, we become perfectly compliant, right? Or more compliant. It's so brazen in a way, right? If we're going to say now the experts with this like plinky planky music in the background and, you know, this, you know, nice little smile and this commercial and talking about things that are really horrifying and telling parents how it is that they ought to parent their own child that leads ultimately to their mutilation. You know, I mean, this is, it's such a power grab. And so people are either going to, and I think we're seeing this now, there's going to be two responses. One is that even non-religious, even non-politically conservative parents now are up in arms, right? You see this at the school board meetings, because it's one thing to be manipulated ourselves, right? And the movement has been manipulating us for a long time through the sexual revolution and through all of that. It's another thing when you see it directed at your kids. And a lot of times people who have been manipulated or abused or what have you, and I think there's a real analogy you can draw between, you know, an abusive person to what the woke movement does, that sort of manipulation. Oftentimes what pulls them out of it is seeing it targeted at their child. So I think, you know, insofar as parents' movement is gonna rise up, if it's not now, I'm a little doubtful what will bring it on. Because if we do not resist it now, then there's no lie that they cannot convince us of.
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we will continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Noel Mehring. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of Awake, Not Woke, a Christian response to the cult of progressive ideology by Noel Mehring. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI. Again, that's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website, equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. Has God spoken? Are the words of Scripture merely human in origin, or are they in fact the very words of God Himself? 3 years in the making and based on two decades of research and reflection, Hank Hanegraaff's monumental book, Has God Spoken?, answers what is surely the most important question facing our world. In Has God Spoken? Memorable Proofs of the Bible's Divine Inspiration, Hank counters the contentions of the Bible attackers and clearly shows that belief in the Holy Scriptures is not a guess or wishful thinking. It is the only logical conclusion after an honest examination of overwhelming evidence. Order Has God Spoken? From the Christian Research Institute by calling 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Equip.org.